On this episode of Big Boys Don't Cry, we discuss the film Beast. You don't have to have seen the film to enjoy the podcast, but if you do listen without having seen the film, you should be aware that some elements of the plot are discussed and are likely to be spoiled for you. Enjoy. Oh, hi.
Hello.
You're in bed.
I am in bed.
I got a text from you earlier saying, I'm literally in bed with my mixer right now. I was like, that's hot.
That is my default, isn't it?
In bed with a mixer.
Exactly. Generally, the mixer of a drinks variety, but today with a mixing desk.
I was just about to make the exact same joke. I was going to say, you love to get down with some ginger beer.
I do love to get down with some ginger beer. Ginger beer and ginger ale. Those are my favourite drinks at the moment, I think. Getting through the ginger ale.
Yeah. Ginger ale's good shit. Underrated, for sure. Canada Dry.
It is. The kids, Canada Dry. The kids these days, they're all about their Pepsis and their Coca-Colas and their Tizer. Kids these days love their Tizer.
Yeah.
They should be on the ginger ale. Should be on the Canada Dry. That's where they should be.
Their Tizer and their R. White's lemonade.
Oh, mate, kids these days, they love their R. White's lemonade.
They're all secret lemonade drinkers.
Going down the park at night with big bags full of R. White's lemonade, drinking it and going on the swings. That's what the cool kids are doing.
They're all kind of slightly too big for them. And, you know, the big swing pole is really buckling under their weight, but they're still giving it a good go.
They are. They're loving it. That's what the cool kids do.
So I'm afraid I am going to be eating Ben and Jerry's throughout this because I have no respect for myself or for our listeners.
Well, I think you have deserved Ben and Jerry's.
It's late at night. It took me 4 hours to get home because of the fucking trains. So there we go. So this is going to be an angry episode. I'm going to be angry about everything because, you know, as a British person, there's lots to be angry about. But one of those main things is trains. So what happens if there's anything goes wrong on British trains? They all act as if it's something that has never, ever happened before and it's the biggest catastrophe of all time, when actually the amount of instances like today where all that went wrong was some twat decided to walk on the tracks at New Malden, then, that's happened 100,000 times before, but they're always like, oh no, we couldn't possibly like have some staff on standby and pay them so that all the trains get back up and running. No, all of the literally millions of people who need to get home from work can go and fuck themselves. So yeah, fuck you, Southwestern Railway. Fuck you.
Trains in this country are an absolute nightmare. At the moment, I'm very glad I don't have to get a train into work because it would be physically impossible for me to do so. As of the 16th of February, there are no trains between Crawley and Brighton, or Lewes and Crawley, which is part of the... Yeah, for an entire week, there are no trains...
Fuck's sake.
They're just shutting them all down for engineering works. So thankfully I don't have to get a train anymore, but I used to have to get a train to work and it would not actually be possible for an entire week.
No,
and then they're
bus.
Going to be messed up all the way through till May, off the back of it as well.
Jesus Christ. It's very bad. Very, very bad.
Remember that we are a country that is determined to leave the European Union because we can do things on our own. But unfortunately, we cannot even get public transport right.
That will definitely enable us to take back control of our railways, most of which are owned by like the French and German state.
Yes, I mean, maybe it's all retaliation.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to own our trains, France? We're going to make them shit. How do you like that? We'll still pay you lots of money for it, obviously.
We'll pay you loads of money. We just won't provide any sort of service whatsoever.
So in conclusion, it's France and Germany's fault that everything here is bad.
It is exactly right.
It's Emmanuel Macron's fault that we're a nation of nostalgic racists.
It is exactly his fault. Just him. Just the Maccas.
I don't know about you, but... Like, right now, and actually, I kind of, I've felt this in a low-key way most of my life, but right now, I'm profoundly embarrassed to be British. How do you feel?
Yeah, yeah, that's me as well. I mean, you just got to read what people in other countries think about us at the moment.
Yeah.
Whereas there was always a kind of, I don't know, I'm not sure if respectability is the right word for it, but there was always a kind of idea from a business standpoint that Britain was kind of like this solid, dependable nation. That has gone entirely out of the window at the moment.
Yeah.
And we've kind of become something of a bizarre uncle that's had too much to drink at a wedding, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, and he, you know, you liked him when you were younger and he bought you toys and stuff, but then as you get older, yeah, he just starts getting drunk and ranting about immigrants and stuff, and then the rest of the family go, oh, well, you know, he's actually got a point. And then before you know it, they're all drunk as well. And you're all standing around and going, what is going on? When did we stop becoming civilized, normal, sane, rational people? When did we become destructive? And then your family's kicking everything, knocking over tables and smashing windows and going, this is what they want. This is the will of the people. And you, all you can do is stand by because they're your family and you can't choose your family. You know, you can't choose where you were born. But if I could, I'd definitely have chosen to be born in Canada. Where I could drink Canada Dry all day.
I would have chosen to be born several years earlier so I could have benefited at not being someone of my generation and make use of all of the benefits that people had before our generation was around. That's what I would have. I'd have a time machine.
Oh, we're throwing time into the equation.
We are throwing time into it.
Right.
I would love to be a baby boomer with an entire welfare state based around my happiness, and then I can go and piss it all up the wall and screw over the younger generations and go, ha, how do you like it, snowflakes?
Yeah, but they didn't have Ben and Jerry's back then.
They didn't. They had benefits and gerrymandering.
Yeah, that's all we're going to have left after Brexit. Ben and Jerry's is short for benefits and gerrymandering.
That is exactly that was their original name, and then they changed it because they realized that nobody liked gerrymandering and only half the population liked benefits, and the rest of them were very angry and gammony about eating an ice cream called benefits.
Yeah, they were furious about the idea that an ice cream could be named after a thing that helps people.
Exactly. They're screaming, why is this not poison flavor ice cream?
Yeah. It's, yeah, if you're poor or you know you don't have a job or you're disabled or weak or vulnerable in any way, you shouldn't be allowed ice cream.
Why are you not spending your money on rice and bread and being miserable?
Oh, not rice. You don't want any of that foreign muck.
No. Potatoes are foreign. What do we have? We have turnips.
Yeah, potatoes come from Ireland. And, you know, the Brexiteers all hate Ireland.
Well, originally they were American, weren't they, potatoes?
Were they? Yeah.
Initially imported from America.
Right.
The same with corn. So you couldn't have, like, maize, could you? Because that's corn-based.
Yep.
So no maize-based snacks. You couldn't have potatoes. You would have crisps. Turnips.
Oh, fucking turnips.
I mean, even chickens. Here's a little food factoid for you, and an animal factoid. Chickens are actually the distant relatives of an animal that initially was around the sort of area of India and Pakistan.
Right.
There was a kind of wildfowl from that area of Asia, and that eventually became the chicken. So even chicken is not an indigenous European thing. We just have turnips and spite. That's all we have.
The only thing that's native to this island is fucking turnips. Have you ever even eaten turnips?
Well, no. I think I've had them in a stew here and there and thought they were the wrong kind of... They're unfortunately not bland enough to get away with the horrible taste of them.
Yeah.
Nearly there. They're nearly bland enough to not have that awful aftertaste. But unfortunately, they're not quite there.
No, they are fucking disgusting. They are the worst of both worlds. They taste horrible and they have a really nasty texture as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's the only thing that's native to our land. Yeah, so oh, in conclusion, fuck everything. Apart from the film Beast. Let's talk about that.
So did you enjoy Beast?
I think I did overall. It was I don't think it's something I would ever return to. And especially towards the end, I found it really relentlessly grim and quite bleak. And usually I don't mind a bit of bleakness, but this was just, it just seemed to go on and on and on of her experiencing bad things happening to her. And then her doing sort of inexplicably bad things that towards the end, I felt a bit disgusted by it. But it was still a very, very effective film and a very, very good piece of storytelling. And it had a lot of ambition, but was still also, I think, very, very realistic. And it was extremely compelling. I think I got really, really drawn in to the story in a way that I don't often get, because I think I don't watch a lot of films and TV that are like this. You know, I skew more towards comedy and inane nonsense than, you know, sort of crime and thrillers and that kind of thing. Not that it's like that, but part of it felt a little bit to me like a sort of, I wondered if it was going to go a bit police procedural, which isn't something that really interests me. But instead it was all kind of a bit bleak and a bit murdery, but also a bit kind of, there's a darkness in everyone, which is kind of true, I guess. So it was philosophical and stuff, and yeah, I thought it was good overall. Had you seen it before this?
Yes, yeah, so I saw it in the cinema when it first came out. And by the way, I realize that this is both the perfect time to watch this movie and the worst time to watch this movie, because it has just won a BAFTA. It won the BAFTA it won the BAFTA for Best New British Film, I think it was. Outstanding debut by a British writer, director, or producer. It won. And so, you know, good timing on that front. Bad timing on the fact that this is technically our Valentine's Day episode.
Yeah.
And I only realised that yesterday. I was like, oh dear. We should have chosen something a bit more lighthearted.
Well, we were going to do Valentine's Day, weren't we?
We were going to do Valentine's
Day. Which is lighthearted to the point of being nothing at all.
Yes. But,
well, there's always next year.
There's always next year. Unless another bleak movie comes out. Or wins awards around Valentine's Day. Yeah. So Beast is very much my wheelhouse.
This is extremely your shit.
It is my shit, definitely. Bleak, unrelenting, horrible, asks questions that you possibly didn't want to have asked in the first place. And I really enjoyed it when I saw it the first time around. I thought it was a fascinating piece of cinema and one of the best things that I saw last year. And second time around, I was just as captivated in it. And the whole movie, it's kind of, there's two kind of strong sort of narrative aspects to it. There is the lovers who are, the outcast lovers who are forsaking society and family. And that's a very strong dynamic, but there is also this mystery element, as you mentioned before, about this very brutal murder. And these two sort of paths intertwine in a quite uncomfortable way. And it's a very uncomfortable film to watch, both in terms of the way that our main characters kind of, they act in quite an unnatural way, but also in a way that feels very human, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why it made me so uncomfortable, is because it was so human. The performances were very, very human. The subject matter was very human. You know, you could imagine it happening to you, even though it gets sort of a bit more warped towards the end. You could still absolutely imagine it happening to you.
Yes. Yeah, so our characters here, we have Moll and we have Pascal. Moll is a woman who was homeschooled after she did something quite awful to another kid who was bullying her at school, and she is in a very sort of protective and quite emotionally manipulative family.
Yeah, the mother is like, her performance is absolutely outstanding, and the whole character of the mother and how she manipulates her and makes her feel like she has to look after her dad, who I think has Alzheimer's and stuff, even though there are enough of the rest of the family around to care for him. She's kind of always making her feel bad about everything she does, but under the guise of love, but not in a way that's sort of horror movie-ish, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah, exactly. The mother, played by Geraldine James, who's an actor that I absolutely love. She's in Utopia, the Channel 4 series. I don't know if you saw that when it was on.
I did not. No.
She's brilliant. So that was around, I think it was around 2013, 2014. All about, it's kind of up your street, but maybe a little bit on the grim side. It's about these people that they're following this cult classic graphic novel called Utopia, which is all about these mysterious like medical experiments and this underground conspiracy and things like that, and they supposedly find the manuscript to the sequel, but it turns out that everything that's being talked about and everything that's being written about by the comic's creator is real. So they get sucked into this conspiracy theory of these secretive all-powerful organizations that are trying to manipulate the world.
Right.
And it's a great show. It's very unique. It has a tone not quite like anything else I've seen before. And it is very vibrant color-wise. It has a really striking sort of cinematography behind it.
Yeah, it sounds really good.
And it's really good. It's a fascinating, brilliant piece of television. And Geraldine James plays a quite prominent role in that. But yeah, so and again in this, she's brilliant as the mother. The whole family. I mean, this is a movie full of monsters.
Yeah.
There's very few people in this film.
That's the whole point, isn't it? Who is the titular beast? It's everybody. Yes,
everybody's the beast. And everybody's awful. I mean, even though we'll talk spoilers a little bit later, I'm sure, you know. But even with every awful thing that people do in this movie, the person that I dislike the most is probably still the sister character, who is just, you know, pulls the "we're expecting" card at someone else's birthday. That's an immediate no-no.
That is a dick move.
That's a proper dick move right there. And then every line of dialogue from the sister is kind of the worst kind of passive-aggressive evil. So that she's probably my least favorite person in the movie, even though you got violent racists, literal murderers.
Crooked cops.
But I think there is this subtlety to it, and the way that it portrays these different characters, and you know, it asks that question of how far would someone go for love, and how far would you be willing to blindly defend someone without knowing what they've done? And how much can you get wrapped up in the idea of a relationship that goes against societal norms and things like that? It's a very, I don't know, it's a very impactful film in that way.
Yeah, and it follows that thread all the way through, right up until basically the very end of the film, when she's like, there's always this kind of question mark hanging over him, Pascal, played by Johnny Flynn. It's like, did he do it? Did he commit the murders? And then in the end, she's like, she's kind of already said like, oh yeah, I want to run away with you and I love you and everything and whatever. So it's like, well, how far would she go? And then she's like, she kind of doesn't press him, but she's like, did you do it? And then he finally admits it. And then she crashes the car and kills him. She strangles him. Which that to me was a bit like, whoa, okay, fine, yeah. I thought there was going to be some redemption, but I guess not. It is called Beast, and Beast is written in a heavy metal font. So there you go.
It is written in a heavy metal font. So in the movie, there's these series of murders of young girls that are taking place across Jersey. It's vaguely based on the real events of this sex offender.
Oh, really?
In the 60s and 70s, who was called the Beast of Jersey.
Right.
So it kind of ties into these real events that happened, even down to the fact that they blamed it on somebody else. And then it turned out not to be them, and that kind of stuff. There are these kind of story parallels to that.
A foreigner, probably.
Oh, not a foreigner in this case, but I think the way that it did tie into ideas of xenophobia within Britain or within the United Kingdom is quite, you know, quite modern.
but it's quite
contemporary for current Britain, isn't it?
The mother quizzes him about his name, and she's like, oh, is that a Jersey name? And he's like, yeah, I'm as Jersey as they come, and it's true. So it's like, and then he makes a joke about like, what are they all doing here on his land or whatever? And they're all just like clearly looking down on him, even though he's actually the one with the claim on the land, which actually is, yeah, so effective about the British you know, xenophobia and nationalist idea, when actually, you know, we're all, you know, descended from Anglo-Saxons who conquered this island however long ago and whatever. So, you know, it's all stupid, really. But they're judging him, even though he's the one who's been there longer.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I mean, like, the name Pascal Renouf, that's pretty much as Jersey as they come, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, so it does tie in quite nicely to, it has this very Jersey feel to it. Not Jersey Shore.
No.
European Jersey.
Not to be confused with New Jersey. This is old Jersey.
This is old Jersey. And it does have that kind of, it feels, it's very authentic as a movie. Not just in the way it portrays its characters, but also in the way it portrays its setting.
Is it supposed to be set in like the 60s or 70s then? Or
no, I think it is supposed to be modern day.
Oh, that's what I thought. But yeah. Most of like the cars are relatively old and the houses and the decor and stuff are all relatively old. But, you know, maybe that's just what Jersey's like. I haven't been. Mm.
Yeah, and I think it's all sort of, it's all supposed to convey... Mole's family is very, very traditional. You know, they are church-going, God-fearing, stiff upper lip folk. They do not talk about their feelings. They just get on with things, and appearances are very, very prevalent in their lives. And I think she as a character, this outcast, is much more open to emotion and much more open to impulse. And so you've got those very heavy clashes. Where they're trying to force her down one path in her life, which she doesn't want to go down. And so, to begin with, it does almost have this kind of romantic feel to it. And that's why I thought it would be quite interesting to talk about on this podcast is, you know, in another circumstance, this would be a rom-com, wouldn't it?
Yes, it could be, yeah. If you sort of twisted a lot of stuff and changed it
If you avoided all the murders, it would be more of a sort of straight up romantic movie about, you know, he is a down on his luck outcast type who doesn't care for the rules of society. She is someone trying to escape from a manipulative family life, and they run away together. You know, that's got all the makings for like star-crossed lovers, but instead it shows that people who are kind of maybe people are attracted to one another if they both feel as though they are broken in some way instead.
Yeah, definitely. And you get the feeling that that's what it's trying to say without doing it too explicitly, actually, which is good. It lets the characterization speak for itself, which is really, really effective and quite different storytelling to a lot of the films that we watch.
Yes, yeah. It's an interesting way to talk about this kind of stuff, where they have this kind of so you never get the sense that either of them is exploiting the other for something. It does feel very natural, but at the same time, it feels like a very destructive symbiotic relationship where you can't imagine it ever ending well, even without the events of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And you feel like at first a lot of stuff is just happening to her, but then because it's all from her point of view, there are a lot of scenes where it should show that she actually has a lot of agency but still has all of these bad and twisted things happening to her. And that's part of why I guess she is attracted to someone who is twisted.
Yes, yeah. And so over the course of the movie, just for the aid of any listeners who you know, maybe haven't seen it and aren't interested in seeing it fresh and want to know a little bit more, Pascal is questioned and arrested over the murders that are happening, but is eventually released. But over that time period, her mental health starts to deteriorate quite massively. So she goes to the funeral of one of the girls. She tries to make amends for. So when she was at school, she, I think, quite violently stabbed another student, didn't she?
And that's why she was with a pair of scissors.
With a pair of scissors, which is why she was then taken out of school. So,
and she claims that it's because she was bullied and it was a retaliation. But then at the end, she admits that she was trying to kill the girl. And she doesn't really go into any more detail than that. But it's enough that for you to think, okay, wow, maybe she does have this kind of really dark, twisted side to her personality that's been being revealed at various points throughout the film, but you feel compelled by her because it's told from her point of view.
Yes, yeah, and that's the kind of I really like it when films do pull the rug out from under you like that, where you are watching something and suddenly your perception of what the character is like changes. And I think there is this kind of idea of redemption in this film, of being able to overcome a past and feel shame for it and atonement. But it kind of also shows that even if you feel that kind of need to atone for past sins, that doesn't necessarily mean that people have to accept that from you. And even if they continue living their lives, you couldn't necessarily just turn around and everything will be okay.
Yeah. And also at the end, that kind of comes to a head at the very, very end, where you realize that she's been trying to redeem herself and trying to atone her sins, but people still won't really, really let her. So she decides to crash the car and kill the person that she loves instead.
Yes. Yeah. And that comes down to, you know, she has forsaken everything. So at the end of the movie, they're sitting down for a meal. There's this moment where Pascal is let out of jail. They've caught somebody else for the murders. And they're celebrating and think, oh, okay, so maybe from this they'll kind of find a resolution. But instead, when she brings it up again, he sort of grabs her by the throat, and you realize that actually this isn't just a roguish character here. This is actually clearly a quite violent and scary individual.
Yeah, and that's kind of, it's very upsetting to watch as well, because you want to root for him throughout the film as well. You know that the copper guy who fancies her and is always like trying to get with her, he tells her about Pascal's previous convictions and stuff, and you're like, well, because he has an ulterior motive, you're like, I don't know, maybe he's exaggerating or not lying, but you question him, and you're like, okay, well, maybe Pascal's okay now because he's showing her love. And because it's from her point of view, as I keep returning to, it's really, really good when a film is able to do that, kind of like a novel, you know, when it's like everything, even if it's written in the third person, is still from someone's point of view. You feel that she loves him and you feel the love between them, so you want to root for him. But then at the end, it is proven that he does have this nasty side.
Yeah, you know, we're conditioned by movies to root for the underdog, aren't we?
Yeah, and especially the film Underdog.
Especially the film Underdog.
Have you seen it?
Is that the one about the magical dog?
Yes, it's a dachshund, and he flies around. Oh no, it's not a dachshund. He's like a spaniel.
Yeah.
And it's a Disney talking dog movie from 2007.
The magical dog movie, aka the Paddy Johnston genre of film.
Yeah, that's extremely my shit.
Exactly. So you've watched so many movies over the years where you are rooting for the underdog. That's who you are expecting to come out and triumph at the end. But in this case, you know, yes, the policeman is corrupt, and yes, he has ulterior motives. And you know, by arresting someone else for the murders, they've shown laziness, a xenophobia. But they only reached that point because Mole lied on behalf of Pascal about where he was.
Yeah, so she's complicit in the murder as well.
She is complicit in the murder. And so there is this moment of violence from him, and suddenly, you know, you feel it in your gut, don't you, when you're watching? It's like, oh no, this is not going to have a happy ending.
Yeah. For and a you're brief like, moment, did she have to lie? She could have just told the truth, but then it's like, of course, that would have set the wheels in motion in a very different way.
Yes, if she had told the truth, he probably would have been appropriately arrested. and his alibi would have been completely defunct. And so they're sitting down for this meal. She wants to leave Jersey altogether. She wants to escape the island and go somewhere new.
Maybe Norway.
Maybe Norway. And he agrees to do it. So they're sitting down for this meal and they're talking about it. And she asks him outright, you know, she says that, you know, we're both the same. She says about how she did try to kill this girl at school. and he admits it. He admits that he is the murderer. And at that point, you're like, I at the first time I watched this, I didn't know what was going to happen next. You know, she, and she tries to go back to the police, and they're not interested. So you've got this kind of, what's she going to do now? Is it that she can find solace in the fact that, you know, there is this violence behind him, like there is this violence behind her? Or is she going to find a way to like get him properly arrested for it? But instead, and it really took me by surprise, it took the entire cinema by surprise, the end of this movie. They're driving along. She asks for a kiss. Whilst he's kissing her, she unbuckles his seatbelt and then turns the wheel of their car, crashing it, sending him flying out. And then whilst he's lying there on the ground, strangles him to death. And then that is the end of the movie right there.
Was there a collective gasp in the art house cinema?
There was not a collective gasp in the outhouse cinema.
The outhouse cinema. You go outside, you have a poo, cinema. You watch a film, you know.
Exactly. I mean, it's the best of both worlds, isn't it? No, there was no gasp, but there was definitely a very awkward, stunned silence when the movie ended.
Yeah.
Because it does, it's a genuinely shocking moment, and it takes quite a lot for a movie to surprise me like that.
Yeah.
And Beast really did it. And you know, it is that whole thing of, that's as far as her love could take it. She could not be with a murderer of that kind.
Even though everything that has led up to that point has led you to believe that she could.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And you know, she has given up everything to make sure that he is safe and that they can be together. And finding that it's all built on that fabrication and built on the fact that he did it, you know, that's that final line that has been crossed. And it doesn't go into details about what happens next, whether she explains the situation or whatever. You know, that is the end of the movie. The resolution of this film is she kills him.
Yeah, that's your redemption.
That's your redemption.
And before he dies, he says, you know, we're the same, repeating what she'd said to him just like a few minutes earlier. But it's like, that doesn't work anymore.
And they're, you know, to be fair, they're not the same. there's a difference between a flash of violence with a pair of scissors, as heinous as that is,
yeah,
and murdering children. it's a pretty big leap. And yeah, it's one of those films I found where it was a bit of a gut punch to watch. And I kind of like those movies. I don't know how you feel about them, but...
No, but... I generally do enjoy them, generally. It's just, yeah, I always end up feeling a bit overwhelmed by them sometimes.
Yeah, and this is a very overwhelming film. If you're in a delicate state of mind, or you've had a bit of a bad day, don't watch Beast, what I'd say. It is unrelenting in its misery, but it does it in, it's not done in a way that's, you know, just full doom and gloom. It's a very interesting movie. But if you want something that's going to make you feel good, this is not the film for that.
Yeah, it's not a film that feels the need to give you satisfaction, resolution and happy endings, but it does have a resolution of sorts.
Yeah, it's got an end. It's
yeah.
It ends. There is a finite moment in this movie.
Yeah, for sure. I think what happens afterwards is she does go to Norway.
Yeah, she just gets up, brushes off the glass. It's like, well, I'm going to Norway, and off she trots.
See ya. Yeah, she lives in like a little snow house.
Yeah, she's in a little snow house, and that's how it ends.
Yeah. But it's good, and yeah, tonally it's quite unsettling as well. The music and sound is quite eerie in places. But at the same time, when it shows the scenes of them being in love and doing lover things, it's quite good, and it's really, really believable and quite uplifting. Like the scenes where they're making love, and when they're like swimming in the sea together, and all of those kind of things, you're like, wow, this is actually really nice and really believable. So. That's the kind of thing that sets you up for the punch in the gut, I guess.
Yeah, there are these moments, and it does really convey young love in quite a emotive way. I found that you did get lost in the romance and the relationship between them.
Yeah. But it would always do like a little bit of it and then suddenly throw you back into some horrible bullshit with their family just to really drag you back to it.
Yeah, you'd either have the mum once again referring to her as her best friend, which is, it's really creepy. Or, you know, another dream sequence where she's being murdered.
Yeah,
geez. Which happens a couple of times. It's quite something, this film. It just hits you with moments.
The point when she has the dream of like the men breaking into the house with knives, I thought at that point it was just going to turn into a horror film, and like I would have been okay with that, but it always feels like it's like it could turn that corner into horror at any point, but it doesn't.
Yeah, and it's got the same kind of atmosphere as some of the most recent sort of alternative horror films that kind of straddle that line between drama and horror and art house and horror. It's got this real unnerving quality to it where you can never quite sit comfortably. And part of that is the characters and the dialogue is always quite strange in this film as well. I mean, it feels very real, particularly between Pascal and Moll.
It wasn't dissimilar to It Follows, which I absolutely loved.
Yeah, I can see that, definitely. It's got the same kind of vibe as It Follows, or a movie that I really loved called It Comes at Night. It had a very similar tone to that. And yeah, it gets under your skin, doesn't it, Beast?
Yeah.
It gets under your skin. It does.
Yeah, especially the family stuff. And as well, you could have taken the family aspect of it and turned that into a really, really effective family drama as well. This could have been like a really long television series almost. There's episodes worth of material in here.
There really is. This could have been. I mean, you've got shows like what's the David Tennant show about the murder?
Doctor Who,
where he's in the sleepy village, Broadchurch.
Oh yeah.
This could almost have a kind of Broadchurch dynamic to it, where you've got this family dynamic and the overbearing family, this dominant family force that you're right. That could fill an entire television show.
This film felt like one of what I imagine those kind of shows are like, given that I never watched them.
This is infinitely better than one of those shows. I think because I don't know, it could quite easily have been a television series. You're right. And I think it could have been a fantastic television series, but the way that you get that depth with very little screen time. And I think there's a kind of magic to that that maybe would have been lost if you actually broke down the intricacies of it in a more sort of like minute detail.
Absolutely. It wouldn't have been as effective. I mean, you just spent the whole series, 6 to 10 episodes, building up to that gut punch at the end, which is a big payoff. But in between, you probably have to endure loads of stuff about her dad having dementia and her cleaning Pascal's house and her singing in the choir and whatever other stuff, which is all works fine as small isolated things in the film. But yeah, it would have been dragged out in those kind of TV shows. And I think that's why I don't watch them, because I think I would get bored by that stuff.
Yeah, I find that some of them are quite boring, and some of them I find the plots become quite convoluted as well. And I think the plot of this is, you know, it's kind of straightforward. There's murders on the island. Did he do it? Yeah, he did it. Now he's dead.
Yeah. She's all right, though. She's going to Norway.
She's off to Norway. She's going to put on her big fluffy boots and go whistling off into the sunset.
Yeah. I'm the Beast.
I am the Beast.
My guest. Be my best.
And it has all of the sort of mechanics of that kind of mystery where you've got the red herring characters and everything like that, but it doesn't need it. And there's such a strong focus on its main two characters that, you know, all of the supporting characters, they have a depth to them that you very rarely get in a film of this kind. And I think it works perfectly as a film. Like I said, it's one of the best films I saw last year. It's really good. I don't know, the fact that this kind of movie isn't the kind of thing that you'd necessarily go back and watch again, but I have been thinking about this film since I saw it.
Yeah.
And I was really excited to watch it again, and I'll probably watch it another time again, maybe later this year or next year.
I feel like it will stay with me. For sure. I only finished watching it today, so it's still very fresh in my mind. And yeah, it's definitely going to be rattling around in my brain for a while, which, you know, I don't think that we would have been able to say that about Valentine's Day. So that's a good thing.
I don't think that would have been rattling around in your head for the right reasons.
No. Isn't Mark Wahlberg in that film?
Maybe.
I'll say, but, well, before I look that up, I just wanted to say, when I was on the Wikipedia page for Underdog, on Rotten Tomatoes, the film has an approval rating of 14% based on 69 reviews.
Nice.
Although, Donald Trump did a 69 meme today, so everything is bad and everything is cancelled.
How did... I don't want to know, do I?
It genuinely really, really upset me.
He's the worst. He's just everyone's uncle, like, distant relative, isn't he?
Yep. No Mark Wahlberg in this film. But it has got just about every other actor that exists in it. So what was Mark Wahlberg doing?
What was he doing on Valentine's Day?
In 2010. He wasn't co-starring with Taylor Swift in her film debut, I'll tell you that.
Oh, mate, you missed out, Mark. Who were you thinking of when you were thinking Mark Wahlberg? Who else is in Valentine's Day?
I don't know. I'll read you the men. Bradley Cooper, no. Eric Dane, don't know who that is. Patrick Dempsey.
Maybe you're thinking of Patrick Dempsey.
I'm going to look at his face. No. He's got like a sexy doctor vibe. It can't be him. Hector Elizondo, Jamie Foxx, Ashton Kutcher.
Maybe you're thinking of Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah.
Taylor Lautner, our main wolf boy.
Our main wolf boy. So, for Valentine's Day, what was Mark Wahlberg up to? So he might have been starring in Date Night, the Tina Fey, Steve Carell.
Okay.
Movie where
who was he in that?
So I think he is he the main, because that's the one where they're off on a date but they get mistaken for spies or something, don't they?
I don't know, but that sounds good and bad.
it stars the main McPoyle from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia as well.
Oh really? Okay,
so ergo it's great and should be seen by everyone. He was also in The Other Guys that year, so he might have been filming The Other Guys, which is a decent enough little comedy movie. It's like have you seen The Other Guys?
I have not.
It's like a spoof of a buddy cop movie where Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg are the two cops who get teamed up to go and solve a crime. But they're the awful cops who get teamed up to solve a crime, whereas the cool ones are The Rock and Samuel L. Jackson.
Right. I have a soft spot for Will Ferrell.
Yes, yeah. And it's a pretty decent Will Ferrell comedy.
Want to see the recent Holmes and Watson film that was absolutely panned.
I really want to watch it. It looks so dumb funny. And I really, I miss those kind of dumb funny films.
Yeah. No, it looks really stupid. And therefore, it's probably up my street. And I love John C. Reilly as well. I feel like even with the worst, like, kind of fartingest dumb gag script, he could probably make it good.
All I know is from the trailers, they punched Queen Victoria in the face by accident, didn't they?
Talk about punching down.
And I am fully on board for watching that. It looks exactly the kind of stupid comedy film that is up my street. The other movie that he was in that year was The Fighter. About a man who fights.
That's about a fighting man. he was keeping busy.
He was busy. He was busy that year. It wasn't as though he was sitting there waiting for the call to be in Valentine's Day. I think he had other things going on.
Oh, well, that's a shame. We'll get around to watching it eventually.
Yeah, maybe next year. Maybe next year.
Yeah. In the meantime, romance is bleak, y'all.
It is indeed.
Shit be real. Oh, yeah. No, Beast is very, very good. A very, very unique and very, very interesting film that you should definitely all go and watch. Unless, yeah, if you're feeling a bit sad or a bit angry, might not be the best time. Watch it when you're feeling relatively chill but open to being affected and punched in the gut.
Yes, yeah. And it did get good award nominations. So at the BAFTAs, it was also nominated for the Outstanding British Film of the Year, pipped by The Favourite, which, yeah, I can see. I think I like The Favourite more than Beast, as much as I love Beast.
Yeah, the Favourite made me howl with laughter, which Beast did not. You know, no. The Favourite is a film you can really take a visceral pleasure in, and you can't with Beast. It's almost unfair that they should have to be compared in any way.
Yeah, exactly. Awards. They're so different, but
which just proves that awards are bullshit.
But at least in terms of my personal enjoyment of them both, I think I did prefer The Favourite.
British Academy, fuck that award.
Big angry fucking trousers awards.
Well, I've won all of those. For my giant bum.
For your giant angry chinos.
Yeah.
So it's got good recognition. I think it's great that it won the award for best newcomer. That's a great achievement, and I think fully deserved. It's rare that you see a film like this from a newcomer that's really as impactful as this is.
So was it written and directed by Michael Pierce, who I do not know. Was it his first film?
So it was his first feature, yeah. Having a little look at his back catalogue, it was shorts before that. So and one episode of a television show. And so this is his first, feature-length film. And, what an achievement with your first. Wow.
Yeah, like, hats off to him for that, because it's really, really competent.
Yeah, it's great. Really, really great film.
Comes across as very, very experienced.
Yeah, and so I'm excited to see what happens next from him.
Yeah, and I think a good cast of people who are not necessarily that well known, but a couple of recognizable faces in there, like Johnny Flynn, you might recognize him. He's been in a few things. You might have known him as a singer, but he's not like a household name. Jesse Buckley was off some reality TV show, and then she's got some quite interesting credits, but not a household name in any way. But still,
Was she off what TV show was she off?
It was one of those ones where it's like a musical sing-off to do a part in a musical.
Where you've got to be the multicolored dream coat.
Yeah,
one of those kind of ones.
It was the one for Oliver Twist. I was going to say Oliver and Company, which is a brilliant film.
Oh, you've got to love Oliver and Company. So I know Jesse Buckley. She's in Taboo, which is a really great TV show written by Tom Hardy and starring Tom Hardy.
Wasn't that the really silly, like, magic-y medieval one that got panned and cost loads of money?
It wasn't medieval. I think it was set in the early 1800s.
Oh, right.
And there's like these weird overtones of like voodoo magic in it, but it's never really explained as to whether it's real or not. And it's this really bizarre drama with these moments of violence and these moments of intrigue. I absolutely loved it. And I think a lot of people went into it thinking, oh, it's Tom Hardy, he's going to punch someone in the face and it'll all be cool. But it wasn't that at all. And it was a really interesting, intricate little series, and I think they're working on a second season at the moment. But yeah, she's in that, and again is great in that.
She was in The War and Peace with them.
She was in War and Peace.
Yep. That's where I recognize her from.
So she's been in some interesting stuff. I think this is a really very rarely given the sort of the real sort of starring role, but I think here she's taken that opportunity and really done something great with it.
Yeah, absolutely. She's very, very good in this, especially as, she's in pretty much every single scene, if not I think every single scene anyway. And it's her story, and so the camera is so often just fixed on her face while she's trying to tell a lie or work something out, or just kind of generally try to deal with all the shit that's being thrown at her, and her facial expressions and all that. Yeah, really, really good. Absolutely nailed it.
Yeah, I can't imagine anybody else in this film. And that's kind of the crowning achievement you can give to someone's performance, that you can't think of how it could be improved by someone else being there, or how it could be equaled by someone else being there. Genuinely phenomenal performance here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Johnny Flynn is great as well. I think the entire cast does a really good job.
He's very good. It's the first thing that I've seen him in, I think, even though he's done quite a few things. I only knew him as a singer, who I thought his music was okay, but it was always a bit kind of, you know, he was part of the Mumford set, and I was a bit like, whatever. But I think his performance in this was very, very good, and it's made me see him in a new light.
See, I don't think I know his music at all.
Rob Sherman was quite a fan back
in
the
really?
Day.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Shout out to Rob Sherman.
Yeah.
We love you, Rob.
Our friend. Yeah. Friend of the podcast.
Literal friend of the podcast, Rob Sherman.
Yeah. Who will never hear this because he doesn't listen to anything. He only consumes media that's carved into trees. Or howled on the wind.
I'll go make a carving for him, and I'll shout it from the top of a mountain.
Yeah. Send the carrier pigeon.
But yeah, so Johnny Flynn, I saw him in, he's in Les Miserables, the new TV series that's based on the book rather than the musical.
I'm not watching that fucking shit. If it doesn't have Do You Hear the People Sing in it, it sucks.
What I saw of it was actually very good.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was decent. But apart from that, I'm not sure if I've seen anything else that he's been in, apart from this and the Cineworld adverts, which he does.
He's in some theatre in the West End at the moment, I think, as well, with a bloke off Game of Thrones, and apparently he's very good in that. I can't remember what the play is.
He's also going to star as David Bowie in a David Bowie movie.
And I think that's great. Great casting. Why not?
Yeah, because I think it's going to be quite a different kind of film to what you would expect, where it's about a very specific time in David Bowie's life, where it's the first time that they're visiting the United States before the Ziggy Stardust era. So I think taking a much more focused look on something like that is a bit of a different way from doing usual biopic. And it stars your man Marc Maron, who I think you like.
Yeah, he's great.
And Jenna Malone's in it as well, who's someone that I like too. So I think there's a lot of potential behind that.
Sounds great.
But yeah, so that's one to watch. And you know, just remember that he was in Beast, and Beast is great.
Yeah, for sure.
So do you have anything else to share about Beast?
No, I think it's very, very good and very competent film in a lot of different ways, and different to a lot of the stuff that we talk about. So thank you for dropping it in. It was it was something of a palate cleanser, I guess.
Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah, a bit. Yeah, something to a very bitter palate cleanser.
Yeah. Like rhubarb.
Yes, yeah.
Or a gooseberry.
Yeah, this is the gooseberry of movies.
A cinematic gooseberry. Now, the gooseberry sounds like that's the kind of horrible bitter fruit that's probably native to the British Isles.
Oh, I'm sure it is, actually. You know what? I wonder, let's do a little bit of research. Foods native to Britain.
Well, pork pies don't count.
No, I bet they don't.
Stuff that actually grows here. They don't.
Yeah,
just,
stuff that actually
trees. It's
because British cuisine is going to be full of stuff that we've just stolen from other places.
Yeah. So it's like, what actually grows in the ground here? Like, as you say, apart from turnips and racism.
Because if you look at like traditional British food, it's going to be things like fish and chips. Was brought to the UK by Portuguese refugees fleeing the Inquisition.
Yep.
So you can't have fish and chips. Sorry, guys, that's from Portugal. Maybe peas pudding. Do you reckon peas pudding is... that sounds like the kind of thing that might be...
Peas come from Russia, don't they?
But peas is made not from peas, isn't it? Peas pudding is a different kind of like pea-type thing. It's like yellow peas or split peas.
You know what? I've never really looked into it, strangely enough.
You're telling me that you've never enjoyed a good piece of peas pudding with some gammon?
Strangely not, no. Non-British listeners who don't know what peas pudding is, or even probably British listeners don't know what peas pudding is. It's spelled P-E-A-S-E, and it's like a horrible dessert, like...
It's not a dessert. It's a savoury.
No, it's a savoury.
It's like the British version of hummus, I suppose, isn't it?
Weird orange.
It's like
paste.
This weird orange gunk.
It's really horrible.
I've had it before and it was fine. I wouldn't say that it's the best thing I've ever had. But it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
It's not as bad as turnips. It's no, it's kind of like Swede paste almost, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's made out of, I think it's split peas.
A Swede is like a turnip, but somehow even worse because it's orange. Or what, is that what the Americans call a rutabaga?
Yeah, that's a rutabaga, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, fucking disgusting. They should stay in the ground where they belong.
Because, yeah, I don't know where split peas come from. Maybe they're not.
What even is a split pea? Isn't it like a pea split in half?
Well, no, because it's a yellow pea rather than the green peas that we normally have over here.
Right. A yellow pea. Actually, on the list of like related things at the top of the Google image search, we got saveloy. Now, saveloy is a British food that I will defend to the death.
Saveloys are the best kind of sausage that you get from a chippy.
Saveloy is extremely good. So yeah, if anyone doesn't know what that is, it's like a quite seasoned sausage that's like weird. It's this like really weird pink colour. It looks horrible, but it tastes amazing.
Yeah, they're awesome, saveloys.
Yeah. Where the name saveloy comes from, I do not know.
I genuinely cannot find anything here about foods that are actually grown in Britain. So as far as I'm concerned, there are no foodstuffs that are truly native to these isles.
So what you're saying is we are all going to die.
We're literally all going to die.
It's going to be fine because the NHS is stockpiling body bags.
Yeah, you've got to love that. That was news I didn't need to see today.
Yeah. Having just watched a very, very bleak film.
Yeah, I didn't need to know that the NHS is stockpiling body bags in case things go bad for Brexit.
Yeah, literally. It'll be fine, guys. There'll be adequate food and enough body bags for all.
Although now they're scaling back on the adequate food. But hey, if you die, you're going to have a body bag.
Oh yeah, wasn't there something about banning eating dogs?
They have looked into the legislation. Well, I think there's already legislation that says don't eat dogs.
Right.
But they've looked into
legislation about eating dogs, yeah. But not about not ruining the economy.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're taking back control, Paddy. What are you, some kind of non-patriot?
Yes. Oh, sorry. Sorry for talking Britain get out, down.
Get out, you Euro-fascist. Why don't you just leave?
I'm going to go to Portugal and eat fish and chips.
Why don't you make like Britain and leave?
Yeah, I will. I'm going to go to Norway. Or should I say Norway plus?
Norway plus plus plus.
Yeah.
Yeah, fuck Brexit, man. I'm fucking sick of it.
It's stressing me out so much. It's the fucking worst. Fuck all of the people who voted for it and fuck all of the people who continue to drag us down the path towards this cliff edge. You know, all of the people who believe in this as a nostalgic, you know, fever dream based on myth. It's bollocks. It's all complete bollocks. And I have no time for it.
I just hope that people find a true love for their country whilst they're eating their next-door neighbour's cat over a fire pit.
Their next-door neighbour's cat rolled into a pink sausage casing so it looks like a saveloy.
Served up with peas pudding.
Yeah.
They're just there. And then the national anthem gets blared out of the mandatory speakers that are now above every house,
There's money for those, but not for food.
Yeah, that's what's going to happen. There's going to be, you know, every hour they play the national anthem, you have to stand and salute and cry as you sing God Save Our Great Teresa.
And there's like dogs walking around everywhere and peeing on everything, but you can't eat them.
Yeah, exactly. Because they thankfully managed to get that piece of legislation through.
Yeah, that's the only one that could get through Parliament. Maybe let's not eat dogs. Co-signed? Yep.
And for once,
can you imagine taking that one to the Queen? I mean, as you know, I'm not a royalist, but I still do think that there is some level of decorum that might be compromised by taking a bill to the Queen and going, "Oh yeah, can you sign this one, please, Your Madge? It's about not eating dogs."
Oi, Queenie, sign this or people are going to eat your corgis.
Yeah, yeah, and the doggy as well. They're not fussy. Because, you know, one of the Queen's corgis is a doggy.
What's a doggy?
A cross between a dachshund and a corgi.
Oh, mate, that sounds amazing.
It wasn't supposed to be there, but on a royal visit, a dachshund met a corgi and the rest is history.
There should be a movie about that. Where's the biopic about the doggy?
Underdoggy. This is the film that I need to make.
That's where we need to go with this.
Yep, definitely. Down the road to hell, as Chris as Chris Rea would have it.
Oh dear. So have we got anything else to share?
No, I don't think so. Beast is very good. You should watch it.
Yeah, go watch Beast. So how are we going to score this? How many rabbits do you bludgeon to death with the butt end of a rifle?
Oh, yeah. There's a bit where, like, she won't shoot the rabbit. Or, like, she doesn't want to...
Yeah, she shoots the rabbit, but then she can't put it out of its misery.
It, yeah.
And it's really horrible and distressing, and I did not like it.
It is nasty, yeah.
Yeah. So how many of those out of 20, Paddy?
Let's see. I'm going to give it 15 rabbits out of 20.
15 rabbits. That's a good score.
So it's a good score considering that it's not something that I would normally watch. So thanks for, you know, expanding my horizons, but yeah, so it's difficult. It's a difficult film to love, but it's extremely effective and competent and very well made and very, very affecting, and hats off to everyone involved.
Yeah. And I'm going to go one higher. I'm going to go for a 16. This film made me feel uncomfortable and I liked it. And it's a really effective film. So I highly recommend as long as you're not in a weak moment, if you're feeling like you've got a bit of strong stuff behind you and you've got that emotional energy to put into a film that makes you feel bad, go and watch Beast. It's a really quite something special.
Yeah. Yeah. Make sure you've got your peas pudding on hand for a light snack.
Yeah, make sure you got your peas pudding and your saveloy and your turnips.
Yeah. Do not watch this film without a saveloy.
You need at least two saveloys and one vat of peas pudding.
Yep. But, you know, this film is a thing that is British that is good. And that's also
a very, very good thing
at a time when most British things are rubbish. This is a British thing that is very good, as is The Favourite. Actually,
yes, yeah, we've got some good British stuff.
Yeah, although Yorgos Lanthimos is Greek, but it's still a British made film.
Yes, yeah. So what are we going to be watching next, Paddy?
Well, this weekend we happened to watch a Canadian indie film called The New Romantic, and it was a very, very interesting film. So I would like to discuss that. So I've already seen it, but I want you to watch it.
Cool. Okay.
It came out last year.
I don't
year.
Know it.
I don't think it got a cinematic release here. Just had a limited release in Canada, but it's interesting. I won't say any more than that, but it's different and deals with some interesting contemporary subject matter.
Is it about the new romantic movement?
Sadly not. No, I was hoping it would just be, it would just be Spandau Ballet.
And just the, adamant.
Yeah. Asking you to stand and deliver whilst holding a banana.
Ah, oh, mate, not out of 20, not enough adamant.
Yeah. Are you adamant about that?
I am adamant.
Oh, adamant. Great guy.
Yeah. Underrated, I think.
Yeah, he's sort of been a bit forgotten, hasn't he? He's not thought of as up there with like Bowie or, you know, similar sort of sexy men who did pop music for a time. But he was very, very big for a while and has sort of faded out, hasn't he?
Yes, yeah. Which I think is a shame because some of his work was really interesting, actually.
Yeah. My old housemate, Alad, whenever he DJ'd, would play the song Goody Two Shoes, which was a very, very good song. I always used to get down to that.
Ah, cool.
Which so your personal favourite... about how Adamant didn't really drink or smoke, but then everyone in the interviews would be like, you know, you don't drink, you don't smoke. So he wrote this song about how he doesn't do those, but instead just has a lot of sex.
So I really love Ant music. I think Ant music is one of my favorite songs of the era.
It's a good one.
Anyway, right, shall we call it a day?
Yeah, I think that's good. I have to go and do some angry sleeping. So
yes.
Yeah. But thanks for recommending Beast. And we'll be back next week to talk about the film The New Romantic. As always, you can get in touch with us on the email bigboysdontcrypodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter @bigboysdontpod. If you have any thoughts on any of the films or any recommendations, always do love to hear them. And if you like what we do, please leave us a rating or review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It genuinely does really, really help. And we'll be back next week. And just thanks a lot for listening. You're great. You're a very good person. If you're British, you're a thing that is good, that is British, that is good.
Yeah, we love you. We love you, the side of Britain that listens to our podcast.
Yeah,
you're good.
You're very good. Well done. Take a day off.
Yeah, go put your feet up.
Yeah, go chill. You've earned it. Sit down with a Savoy and a peas pudding.
Get your peas pudding out.
You deserve it.
Go down to Peas Pottage with your peas pudding. Get your Savoy. Have a good time.
Yep. You've earned it. All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Savoy.
Savoy.
It's like Oi Oi Savoy.